Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Joining us today is Corey Massimino. He's a fellow at the Center for a Stateless Society. We're going to be talking about the political ideas of Murray Rothbard, which is the subject of a chapter Corey's authored for the upcoming Rutledge Handbook of Anarchy and Anarchist Thought. Welcome to Free Thoughts, Corey.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Can you start by giving us a sense of who Rothbard was and the influence he's had on 20th century libertarian thought?
Sure. So Murray Rothbard was perhaps the major, at least in the top three libertarian thinkers in the 20th century, one of the most prolific writers of anyone of any political ideology. Authored, you know, dozens of books, articles, essays. He wrote constantly for his whole life. So there's lots of material and literature to draw on when you're looking at his ideas and trying to parse out his positions, which changed over time sometimes. And he's mainly, I think his most popular book among libertarians is probably For a New Liberty, which he wrote in 1973, which is kind of a manifesto for his version of libertarianism at that time. Which could be understood as a kind of like mainline libertarianism. It's after his period of allying with the New Left, and it's before his period of being more of a paleo libertarian. And I think that's been a big, you know, because you have some people who are really hardcore Rothbardians, but as you asked about just the broader libertarian movement in America, you know, as it's understood as a political ideology, it was a lot to Rothbard and his books like For a New Liberty and how he spelled out his ideas.
You mentioned these kind of phases in his life, like the reaching out to the New Left and then the paleo-conservative stage. Should we understand those as strategic moves by his, looking for different political alliances or ideological changes of mind that he had?
I tend to think, you know, it's hard to psychologize, you know, someone, especially that you've obviously never met. My read on that stuff is kind of, it's hard to distinguish between, you know, in theory that you can distinguish between, was it for strategical purposes or was it because of a genuine change in ideology? But like those things kind of tend to run together. I mean, once you start strategically allying with the New Left and you're going to all these protests about Vietnam War and you're talking to all these New Leftists, I mean, your ideas are probably going to start to shift a little bit and come a little closer to the people you're surrounding yourself with and the ideological climate that you kind of immersed yourself in. So I think often strategical was at the top of his head with his decisions. I think he was pretty clear about always trying to find the best avenue and best political affiliations to spread his idea of liberty at whatever time it is. And that's why it shifts so much in his life. At first, in the 50s and early 60s, when he's starting to write, he writes his treatise, Man, Economy, and State in 1962, I think. And, you know, during that time, he's a big fan of the old right from, you know, maybe a decade or two prior, you know, and people like Mencken and Oppenheimer and Nock. And he sees, you know, that as the main way to advance liberty, you know. But then the 70s come along and Vietnam comes along, and more importantly, the Cold War really intensifies, and that really pushes him to go away from the conservatives, which he views as you know, they became a lost cause because of the Cold War, I think, is his position. And the old right didn't exist anymore. And now there was this emerging, you know, new, you know, kind of radical ideas that he was attracted to in the 70s. And so I think he started to ally with them. And he's still critical of certain leftist things in the time period, for sure. And it wasn't, you know, long before the New Left itself sort of collapsed and disintegrated into competing factions. And Rothbard just abandoned it too and realized, well, this isn't strategical anymore. You know, I got to carve out my own kind of new path. And then you fast forward a couple of years and he starts to see paleoconservatism as the best ally for libertarianism. And I think, again, mainly because that's when you get to the late 80s and the early 90s at the end of his life, the Cold War was over. So he saw, again, like, well, maybe the right can be salvaged and allied with for a libertarian cause. And he was very pessimistic about the left, because in the early 90s you had you know, you had a just like now, the last few years, you had a wave of, you know, political correctness sort of discourse around, similar to what we're experiencing. And he was, you know, very paleoconservative on these issues and really pushed away from the left. So at the end of his life, those were his alliances there. And I think his ideas probably shifted more towards paleoconservatism at that time, because that's who he was around. That's who he was reading and who was reading him, you know, and that's who his friend circle was. That's who his financial support was. But we know all throughout his life, he liked to burn bridges. He liked the strategical element of politics almost as a game.
Before we dig into his thought, because of his shifting alliances and his shifting views over the course of his life and how that plays into your argument, it might be helpful if we took a moment to have you just explain what you mean by the new left and what kind of the core of their views was, and what you mean by, like, what is a paleoconservative? What do they believe?
Well, the new left, I would say, was characterized mostly by, you know, an opposition. I mean, the big thing was the Vietnam War at the time, and I think that united everyone, and that united a lot of radical leftists that opposed the status quo, American governmental, economic, political system, with a lot of different details and specifics under that one big, you know, header, new left. You know, and you even have one of the presidents of the Students for Democratic Society, the hallmark new left organization at the time. He himself identified as a Rothbardian, Carl Oglesby. He's a quite an interesting new left thinker that you can find. And he was influenced by Rothbard. And sort of, if we put it in language today, he would be an advocate, I think, of bottom unity, or, you know, the idea that the two bottom quadrants on the political compass, the two libertarian quadrants, ought to try to work a little more together and against the authoritarian quadrants because of their common affiliations. And so the new left, I think, was mainly against the war, against militarism, and it saw that really entwined with the corporate state and the military industrial complex and, you know, policing at home and corporatism and neo-mercantilism. And Rothbard was on board with all that stuff, and he, you know, wrote about it quite a bit. But when you get fast forward 15, 20 years, and you get the Cold War is ending, and conservatism is kind of changing a little bit, and there's this paleoconservatism that he kind of hooks onto, that he gets drawn into. And I would say the central thing that characterizes paleoconservatism is it's distinct from, you know, neoconservatism. It's, you know, it tries to have this, you know, non-interventionist foreign policy, while at the same time, you know, advocating for minimal government in economic spheres, say, you know, and advocating for at least, you know, culturally conservative attitudes on most issues of things like gender and race and sexuality and religion. And he, by the early 90s, was very much interested and invested in these culturally conservative attitudes, as he saw as pretty important. But he didn't want the government to mandate anything about it, obviously. He never repudiated anarchism, but he did say, you know, his most infamous quote is from the early 90s and an essay where he says to unleash the cops, you know, to administer instant punishment on the people on the street, you know. And so it's a weird shift where he was, you know, he was more allying with the Black Panthers against the cops in the new left phase, and then, you know, by the early 90s he's being squishy and squeamy on his anarchism and supporting, you know, more police action.
So despite these phases that we've been discussing, you argue that there are some core things. As you said, he never repudiated his anarchism, even though he might have had some poorly chosen words at different times. So we can go through those. One of them you point out is that he was a lifelong believer in natural law and morality based on natural law. How did he view that?
Yeah, so I would say the one of the biggest elements that forms the foundation of his thought, and it can be really seen throughout, is Aristotelian natural law, you know, in the tradition of Aristotle and Aquinas, viewing, you know, humans as natural entities in the world, with a certain nature and with a certain function, a certain thing that's unique and specific to humans that distinguishes them from the other natural entities in the world, particularly non-person animals, and that's, you know, our rational faculty, our capacity to choose and decide our ends and you know, form projects and goals, and by extension, cooperate with other agents who are forming projects and goals. And so that's a big thing for Rothbard. He at first wasn't, I mean, his teacher was Mises in the 50s. So Mises did not like natural law at all. He was utilitarian of sorts. But when Murray came into contact with Rand, he, you know, he's quoted in a letter as saying that Rand showed him the glory of natural rights, and they had a schism and split off. So he never attributes his ideas to Rand. But if you read, you know, his major work on here, The Ethics of Liberty, the first few chapters, they could have been written by Ayn Rand. You know, I would argue they're right out of her similar Aristotelian liberal framework that sees this connection between, you know, the rational action necessary for a virtuous life and the good life, a connection between that and a connection between the freedom and autonomy granted by liberal political orders. And in Rothbard's case, you know, full on anarchism without any government. So natural law for him is kind of that moral base for that he sticks his anarchism on top of.
What's the scope of rights for Rothbard drawing from that Aristotelian tradition? Because if you can imagine, if the argument is that we have these faculties and a nature, and that is tied into a good life, and so a good life is being able to exercise these sort of things, and so if I interfere with your exercise of, you know, rational choice and self-authorship and so on, I'm interfering with your ability to lead as good a life as possible. But you could also imagine saying, well, but that also means that we should be positively providing for you, because if what matters ultimately is that you lead a good life, there's lots of things that you need beyond, you know, just autonomy in order to live well, or lots of things we could do to help you live well. And so you could see it on the other end of the spectrum, potentially justifying much more robust, say, positive liberties or intervention or resource transfer or so on. So how does he, where does he come down in that spectrum, and how does he get to there from these priors?
For sure. That's a good question. Most, you know, most Aristotelians following Aristotle have been, you know, much more to the communitarian side of political theory, whereas Rothbard is on the more individualist side. And you know, and that makes sense, because for Aristotle, political community is completely central and essential to human society and human nature. He sees a very, very close connection between our rational nature and our language using nature and our political nature. You know, like I said, the rational faculty we have is what enables us to cooperate with other rational actors. So all of these are sort of intertwined for Aristotle, and that's why he calls us a social animal or a political animal at times. And most thinkers in history have taken that to say, okay, well, that means we need a state, right? Politics, that's a state. The state represents the community in some facet, and then helps everyone be virtuous. Like you said, provides for them and helps them habituate their dispositions to become virtuous, just like Aristotle says. And Rothbard, I mean, he couldn't disagree with this more. He kind of thinks it's a big assumption, a big leap from, well, we're political animals, social animals, to government. You know, he doesn't deny that we're social animals. He just sees different implications of that fact for political theory, and says that, you know, as social animals, the first and foremost feature of justice, you know, of that virtue is going to be non-interference, in a way, is going to be respecting the space of another's autonomy. Because, you know, he really thinks virtue and rational deliberation, it's impossible when you're coerced. You're taken out of the realm of action itself, of human action, and into mere motion. That's kind of how he talks about it. And so it's not that he would deny any positive duties towards other people, because he wouldn't deny that at all. But he says, you know, a minimum of justice, a necessary but perhaps insufficient condition of justice, is that non-interference principle with people's projects and self-authorship, as you put it.
So he tends to get for a lot of people, or some people love the with his view of natural rights, quite absolutist. Of course, the idea that taxation is theft is a good example, but it gets into some pretty abstract conversations sometimes that he seems to countenance to no degree any possible right violation, and almost seems to view, you know, as the same as flicking you on your arm is cutting off your entire arm. They're both rights violations, or shining a laser pointer on your door. Or I think he had a pretty famous essay in the Cato Journal in the 80s where he kind of argued that if you take pollution and environmental harm and you take rights seriously, you might have to shut down factories wholesale because they're polluting and therefore violating rights. Is that kind of accurate, or am I mischaracterizing, you think, in terms of how absolutist he was on rights violations?
No, I don't think you're mischaracterizing him. This is why, because when he lays the foundations, the ethical foundations for his rights theory, I mean, he's thoroughly Aristotelian. But when he actually gets to the rights theory, and that's what he spends most of his time on, not just in his book on ethics, the Ethics of Liberty, but just in his career in general. He doesn't talk much about the ethical foundations of rights that he roots in Aristotle, but the application of rights. And in that regard, he is very absolutist. And so people sometimes forget or miss his Aristotelian foundations and interpret him as kind of more of a deontologist. And that's not ridiculous because, you know, it is fundamentally about that classic deontological principle of Kant's that, you know, you treat people as ends and not mere means, as ends in themselves. And so he... You know, in that sense, okay, but for him, it's still all part of that broader Aristotelian framework. And I'm glad you brought up that the Cato article. I think I cite that in the book chapter because it brings up a very interesting distinction to where you might think of force and violence and these terms of of interfering in others' projects, and you might think of these in excessively physicalistic terms, you know, in the sense that. We can figure out where an instance of interference has occurred by just looking at the, you know, objectively definable physical facts of the situation empirically. And then we can determine the normative analysis of this. And I mean, this gets really into the weeds of rights theory, but Rothbard, you know, in that Cato article on in the context of pollution as a rights violation, you know, he denies this physicalistic view, and instead favors what you could call, and I did not come up with a distinction, but I cite it in the book chapter, and I wish I remembered the author who kind of put it in these terms. I think in a Journal of Libertarian Studies article a few years ago. But the idea is that instead of a physicalistic conception, you have a praxeological conception of rights. And so you, keeping at the center of your mind when you're looking at rights is not necessarily just the bare facts of the physical interactions in the material world, but it's a kind of a thicker, more robust sense of action in the sense of projects we undertake. So that's how he gets to the conclusion that in a lot of cases, these instances of pollution are rights violations, not because the molecules of the gases that companies pollute the air or water with come into physical contact with the molecules of my, lake that I might own or the air around the house that I own. It's their rights violations because they interfere in some important way with the undertaking of projects that other people are engaged in. So your example of like shining a light on someone or like flicking their wrist, like those are rights violations in a physicalistic sense, but that's a less useful way than the more action oriented one that Rothbard wants to argue for. So you get some perhaps counterintuitive conclusions that maybe a lot of pollution actually is a rights violation, and we need, you know, and he wants this very, you know, complex system of kind of tort law and property rights to help resolve those issues. But that saves him from having to bite the bullet on a weird issue like shining a laser pointer on someone is a rights violation because it doesn't interfere with, you know, if you're blinding them, okay, that's interfering with their projects. But if you're not, then it's a very minimal sense in which it's really interfering.
So then this very strong conception of rights turns into individualist anarchism, which you say is the second of the four frameworks.
Yeah. Rothbard draws heavily on Spooner, on Lysander Spooner, And also Benjamin Tucker, another 19th century American anarchist. He, you know, again, at first he was just exposed to Mises, the seminars at New York University. And so he had this Misesian kind of Austrian framework, and we'll get to that later, I know, because that's another, another part. But he has that background, and then he encounters, I believe it was Bastiat through like a fee pamphlet back in the 50s. And through Bastiat, he found Molinari, and he found the French anarchists, and then he found the American anarchists, Spooner and Tucker, and he kind of brings that into his existing ideas and with the natural rights. And so he kind of revives in a lot of ways this more liberal variation of anarchism, instead of more communitarian or collectivist visions of anarchism that really dominated anarchist space and thought for the first half of the 20th century. He revived the stuff that kind of went away with the 19th century American anarchists. And so he dubs this, although I don't think I think Karl Hess coins this term, but Rothbard becomes the founder or the accepted founder of anarcho-capitalism, which, you know, many anarchists denies even anarchism, maybe that we'll get into that later. But nonetheless, he distinguishes a little bit from the individualist anarchists of the 19th century, because he has this Austrian bend, he has this natural rights bend, he has his own specific thing, and he likes the term capitalism, and so he calls it anarcho-capitalism. And I mean, that starts, you know, that's kind of a huge move and a huge thing, you know, for good or bad, depending on your views, obviously, that spawned, you know, tons of work and new literature and research, you know, to this day, the last 50 years of you know, dealing with that idea, essentially with you know, liberal anarchism as I think it should be viewed.
So you had mentioned and alluded to it, but of the time and the kind of tradition of anarchy up to Rothbard, I guess we have, due to have Tucker and Spooner there, but how did he play with other anarchists, maybe contemporaries of his, and, you know, where were they coming from more usually if they weren't coming from the capitalist side?
Yeah. He was in deep tension with, you know, contemporary anarchists of the time, and there wasn't much discourse really between them, I think, you know, because neither side really wanted to admit the other one was genuine anarchism. I mean, they write things about the other side. Rothbard wrote things about anarcho-communism or collectivist visions of anarchism, which he says, you know, they're really, it doesn't even make sense to consider them anarchism, and that they would, you know, in addition to that, they would also just be horrible, impoverished societies as well. On the other side, anarcho-communists have written about anarcho-capitalists, Rothbard being the foremost one, and argued, you know, this shouldn't even count as anarchism, and would lead to a really undesirable, unequal society with lots of domination that anarchists see good reason to oppose. You have Noam Chomsky, who has not really engaged with Rothbard's thought, but has said before that Rothbard's vision is something like a world full of hatred and built on hatred. And it's kind of this bizarre straw man. Like, that gives you a sense of like how, you know, anarcho-communists and anarcho-socialists of that bend, you know, might see Rothbard in his vision, which I think is really unjustified and really just a silly kind of accusation, like a world built on hatred. Obviously that's nowhere in Rothbard's work. You know, and you have exceptions. Rothbard knew Murray Bookchin, and they seem to interact a bit, not in publicized debates or anything, sadly. But I think just more in real life, they actually knew each other and talked. But there really is this huge gap between, and still to this day, obviously, most people of these camps don't consider the other ones genuine anarchists and think their ideology is really horrible and kind of, you know, doesn't contribute anything worthwhile.
How does the distinction between capitalism and free markets fit in here? Because libertarians typically, like a lot of libertarians, will use those two terms interchangeably. And so an anarcho-capitalist is simply someone who thinks that you should have anarchism plus strong property rights in the markets that result from them. But then there are people like left market anarchists who say, no, capitalism is something distinct from markets and actually something that, you know, ought to be rejected in favor of markets. So what is an anarcho-capitalist, say, versus a market anarchist?
So I'm definitely coming from the left market anarchist perspective, and part of the chapter is trying to bring Rothbard and his frameworks that we're discussing into dialogue and into more closer vision with left market anarchism. And so I would describe distinction, you know, as Rothbard didn't distinguish between markets and anarchism. The American anarchists that we discussed earlier, like Spooner and Tucker, tended to distinguish between markets and capitalism. The 19th century, that was mostly before capitalism was used as a positive self-identifier. It was often used by people like Tucker and Proudhon and, you know, later Marx and even Ricardo, I think, that it was used to describe, you know, a system of concentrated capital ownership, which may or might not, you know, have, you know, property rights and price signals, even in profit loss mechanisms. You know, it could have those things. It's not mutually exclusive with those features that we associate with markets. But for them, capitalism referred specifically to a system that had this concentrated ownership of capital. And that's why people like Spooner and Tucker also called themselves socialists, which again is really doesn't fit into our modern sort of understanding of these terms. The Cold War sort of permanently fixed these concepts, socialism and capitalism, and they're not able to be in dialogue with each other anymore, sadly. But in the 19th century, that was before the Cold War, and that was before this really hard distinction took place. So you have anarchists like Proudhon and Tucker and Spooner and De Clare, and it's not really clear how they fit between this dichotomy. And so anarcho-communists and anarcho-capitalists constantly, they often fight for, you know, who was the real intellectual heritage, you know, what, you know, actually Tucker was only a socialist or he was only a capital, you know. And so Rothbard kind of doesn't pick that up from them. He keeps the understanding of capitalism just as markets that he gets from Mises and Rand, and who were the probably the two biggest authors that in the early 20th century that came to really stick capitalism with pure, you know, laissez-faire free markets, you know, in their liberal understanding. And so the distinction I think that I try to make, you know, is that, you know, capitalism can be understood as the system where, you know, capital is in the hands of a few, and most people are then, you know, left with little option but to work in wage labor for the few with capital. And this is distinguished from markets because the vision of markets that people like Tucker and Spooner had was not one where people worked for capitalists for wage labor, but where people kind of combined their efforts and labor through things like worker cooperatives and more horizontal forms of economic production. And he saw those as preferable and in fact likely given the economic incentives of laissez-faire. And Rothbard, you know, denounces that. He in places argues against this view and says, you know, it's capitalism just is capitalism as a lot of people performing wage labor for capitalists, not just as free markets, but capitalism that even in the thicker sense, he says, you know, it is more of this organic result from markets because people have different preferences and consumption patterns and savings patterns. And so some people accumulate more capital, they save it up, and then other people work for them and get an advance on their income. And he says, this is kind of, you know, this is fine. This is organic. This is part of free markets. What's not part of free markets, you know, is corporatism and what he calls, you know, really at times neo-fascism, this kind of corporatist system that he associates with 20th century America, with the Progressive Era and New Deal reforms and the military industrial complex and all that's kind of connected to him. But just bare wage labor for other people for him is an organic result of markets and totally fine. Whereas left market anarchists see it as there is moral questions there, and that's undesirable. A lot of people working for wage labor for a few, and also unlikely with the incentives of, say, a laissez-faire economy. So that would be the distinction.
You also, the third pillar kind of as we're going through these for Rothbard's thought is liberal class theory, which seems like a strange kind of combination of words where class theory has historically been associated with Marxists. So what is Rothbard's view on class theory?
Yeah, so class theory plays an important role for Rothbard. And the phraseology will sound strange, you know, to a lot of modern readers, you know, but class theory predates Marx. You know, Marx's class theory was a specific variation on earlier class theories that Marx was inspired by and then specified in his own little ideology. and his specifics. But you know, the early French liberals, like Bastiat and Molinari and Comte, and they're talking, you know, before Marx, about this idea that that we can understand social phenomena in a way through these stratified classes, you know, and they all have a kind of specific variations and details of their vision, but broadly that, you know, that we can understand these two classes, and all the French liberals really tended to associate the origin of class division with the state, whereas Marxists see it, if Marx himself sees it this way, is perhaps up to argument, but almost universally, because Engels very much cemented this view among Marxism, they view the class structure as an organic result of markets at all. And if you have markets, that will inevitably naturally result in the stratified system of class system and a stratified class ownership capital ownership that I was referring to. And so, you know, they say, you know, no to markets even at all. Whereas the liberal class theorists, they say the market is not the source of class stratification. You know, we haven't had free markets. We've had state intervention and colonialism and theft and land theft and slavery and corporatism now in the last 150 years. And so they view the source as the state, as this source of social division by privileging people with access to political power, access to the violent apparatus of the state, access to the taxing and regulating powers of the state. They use that to their benefit as a kind of entrenched elites. And this is how they see, you know, capitalism in the sense of widespread wage labor is itself can be a product of the state itself, because capital would be more widespread and easier to access without all these barriers to entry and the marketplace and competition and licensing and regulation. And, you know, so Rothbard draws on that quite a bit. But again, obviously, he doesn't attribute capitalism itself to the state. He's fine with capitalism, but he does draw on the liberal class theorists very heavily, because he definitely views the American economic system, starting probably with the progressive era, you know, supposedly altruistic reforms, and then into the New Deal reforms. He views these things as all really taken on by big businessmen and supported and even often designed by big businessmen to better protect their monopolies and their status from competitors in the marketplace that might arise and take customers away from them and produce better, cheaper products that put them out of business eventually. You know, and on this, he really draws heavily from, this ties back into his association with the New Left, because he draws heavily on New Left historical revisionists like Colco and Galbraith. And they are writing, you know, at that similar time about how, you know, we have the story wrong. You know, the Progressive Era and the New Deal weren't these great altruistic, positive for the working classes reforms. They hurt the working classes more. They stratified the market more. They benefited entrenched elites with access to political power. And so Rothbard takes that. And even though he leaves the New Left, he doesn't abandon this view. He talks, you know, in For New Liberty, which is after the New Left phase, about this as well, about neo-mercantilism and how, you know, the 20th century has been far from a free market. It's been a system of corporatism that benefits these elites. And, you know, he keeps that view even to his paleo phase. And this is where paleoconservatism, to go back to that a little bit, distinguishes itself from conservatism more broadly as we understand it in America. Because paleoconservatism, you know, we're seeing this is becoming much more apparent the last few years, especially with Trump, though not to get into Trump, but the idea that, you know, there is this initial skepticism of big business as, you know, as these elite, you know, these elites that are benefiting from some sort of unfairness in the system. And so paleoconservatives, even though they're not anti-capitalist, obviously, of any leftist variety, they're often skeptical of big business. And Rothbard kept that kind of skepticism throughout his life.
Let's hit on the fourth one before we move to your critiques of Rothbard, and that's Austrian economics, that he pulls this together into this economic theory.
Yeah. So Rothbard was obviously an economist first and foremost. That's what his degree is in. That's what his teaching was in. And that is the major focus of most of his work. It's more an economic analysis. But he obviously was a philosopher and historian and political theorist as well, because he was such a wide-ranging thinker. And in the economics realm, he very firmly inherits this praxeological framework from Mises by attending his seminars in the 50s. And then he himself writes a human action-esque treatise on economics called Man, Economy, and State in 1962. And Mises praises that book in his review. Mises is a fan. So Rothbard kind of brings the other three parts, the natural law, the individualist anarchism, and the class theory. He brings this all into a whole, these four aspects, which is quite a novel synthesis. It's certainly very, very disparate traditions historically, to some extent. Certainly no one before Rothbard, as far as I know, really tried to integrate all these kind of different ideas from different traditions in this kind of interesting way. And so, Austrian economics starts with, Menger and Bombach in the 1800s, and then Mises, and then Hayek and Rothbard, and you have a lot more in the last 50 years. And so I guess a little overview of Austrian economics for Rothbard is the view that we can figure out a lot of economic theory purely from analyzing the conceptual terms of human action. Of the way that our means are related to our ends, how our goals and our projects are interrelated, and how we economize on resources that are scarce, both material resources and things like time. We economize on these things necessarily by acting, and when we act, we have these trade-offs and opportunity costs. And so he's really against at the time when he's writing in the 60s, especially, there's this big push in economics for a much more statistical, mathematical, conception of economic analysis, seeing more to gain from statistical aggregates and mathematical equations than conceptual analysis. And Rothbard's firmly on the side of conceptual analysis. He's very little, if at all, use for the statistical stuff. So Man, Economy, and State is kind of this broad overview of this. It's kind of an in-depth analysis of tracing out the implications of these core ideas about human action, about the nature of human action, how it economizes on scarce resources to attain future ends. And he talks a lot about how this has implications for all these areas of economics and prices and property and capital and how these things emerge and interact. And there are other elements to his Austrian stuff. I think maybe worth mentioning here is he has an interesting contribution in Man, Economy, and State, arguably his major novel economic contribution, is in, so back up a little bit because you will need to understand, Mises slightly to get Rothbard's contribution. Mises in like 1920, he writes Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, and he puts forth this new argument that really shakes things up and really changes the tide of things, about how rational economic calculation is impossible without property rights and the profit loss mechanism that emerges from those property rights. And Rothbard takes this and says, socialist societies, the reason they can't allocate resources efficiently and rationally, isn't necessarily because of their use of force, although that's central to understanding those societies, but the irrational economic stuff is due to the monopolized control over all the resources, all the productive resources, land, labor, materials, all these factors of production in a given territory. And so there's no way for prices to emerge that reflect individuals, changing and shifting preferences and plans and projects and talents, So Rothbard says, and this can be seen in the way that socialist states have historically relied on prices from the world market and sometimes prices from domestic black markets to perform internal economic calculations that they wouldn't be able to otherwise without the prices emerging from elsewhere. And Rothbard says, we can think about this in the context of the firm. You know, the firm is famously an island of central planning, in a sense. You know, the firm is not a market. It exists within a broader web of interactions that is the marketplace. And so a firm is a system of conscious organization. It's not a spontaneous order. A firm, if, you know, a firm is this deliberate, concerted action on the part of multiple individuals. And he says, you know, if as a corporation or a firm or a business, as opposed to social estates, as those organizations come to acquire more resources and more of the machineries and capital and factors of production in a territory and in the market, then there's nowhere for the prices to emerge outside of the firm, just like there's nowhere for the prices to emerge when a social estate has a monopoly over everything. You know, so he says you're left with this similar irrationality inside the firm as they become bigger and bigger and more insulated from the price system. Then they have to rely on faux prices that they create internally, and less efficient, less effective, and less knowledge yielding systems of coordination within the firm. And so that's related to his skepticism of big business and ties into the left market anarchist analysis as well.
So as an anarchist in the broader tradition of anarchism, you have some, you know, he's not, as you've mentioned previously, I think a lot of those people, you know, maybe people protesting right now who might casually call themselves anarchists would not really go near Rothbard because they're pretty anti-capitalist. But what kind of mistakes do you think Rothbard made in that way in terms of understanding even the broader anarchism, even the ones who don't have anything to do with him?
So I think it's a really broad kind of issue, and it's not just for Rothbard, but you know, for in general, how a tradition that was initially just libertarianism or anarchism in the early 19th century diverged into two completely separate directions, left and right libertarianism. And the left one being, and this is, I mean, left libertarian has many, many terms. This is one usage that's the oldest of it, which is, you know, anarcho-communist, anarcho-socialist, collectivist, anarchist, as we discussed earlier. And the right libertarianism being, you know, markets and if not full-on anarcho-capitalist like Rothbard. But like I said, his view, you know, his view is that these guys probably don't count as genuine anarchists even, and their ideas are pretty horrible. You know, they don't understand economics. They're not sufficiently opposed to the state, even though they are, you know, in letter and in theory. You know, he's very skeptical of their credentials to you know, anti-statism, I guess I would say. And I think he's mistaken because there are aspects of traditional anarchism, obviously, that he has nothing to do for or nothing to use for, and it makes sense for him to reject. But the general anarchist skepticism of interpersonal domination, and as opposed to mere aggressive force and physical violence, which is what Rothbard is mainly focused on, both things have real moral relevance. Both the physical violence that Rothbard is concerned with and the moral, the interpersonal domination that may involve physical violence, but cannot be reduced to it and may involve other things.
What do you mean by domination, just to clarify?
So, I mean, there are many ways you can think about domination. In the chapter, I try to talk about it as the power one person holds over another, insofar as the one person is deprived of essential needs. And so acquiesces to the will of the person with power over them because they have little option. Otherwise they will lose essential needs. So, you know, an example is, you know, a very poor, you know, worker who's working for someone who pays them in wages. And if they have little option outside of that, and they're going to starve without their weekly or monthly wages, they'll acquiesce to the will of the other person. And there's no physical violence there. The scarcity of resources that leads to poverty is a natural condition of the world. I mean, this is the Austrian economics. You know, scarcity is this omnipresent feature. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't follow that everything's just fine and dandy with that interaction, because the person with power didn't actually use any physical violence against the other person. There's still, to me, something morally questionable about a person spending 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, you know, almost a third of their life, basically acquiescing and taking the orders of another person in a way a school child or a prisoner even would. And so obviously, you know, this is a broad topic. There's a huge range of what domination can entail, even in the case of the employer-employee relationship, how, you know, the range that, of those, you know, there's so many kinds of those relationships and they cannot be reduced to any single one. But Rothbard doesn't give much concern for anything beyond physical violence. For most of his life, he thought basically the only thing that really mattered was just physical force and violence. And his analysis of morality and economics emerges from that focus. Towards the end of his life, he started to realize, well, libertarianism can be logically extricated from other matters, psychological, cultural, and social matters, but it can't be in practice separated from those things. So he came to care for cultural and psychological and social issues, which could include a care for domination, but in his case, it didn't. It was very much a dismissal, you know, of these ideas. He called them victimologies. And that's what he would say about the second half of my chapter, at least late Rothbard. Obviously, he was very different, as we discussed earlier, throughout his life. But, you know, he kind of denigrates this whole list of what you might say left-wing commitments, things like feminism and anti-racism and anti-ableism, things that are intended and often associated with the anarchist tradition because they are opposed to systems of domination of some people over another. And he's really skeptical of all this stuff, especially by late in his life and you know, with his paleoconservatism. But I think he's mistaken. I think the anarchists are onto something. I think we can care about both. I think we might say that violence is itself a form of domination, albeit not the only form. And we don't have to say that violence is an acceptable solution to domination in general. I still agree with Rothbard, and I think anarchists in general should to consider this view more seriously, that violence is only okay in response to violence. You know, the only force that's justified, it has to be defensive in nature.
What do you think non-anarchist libertarians, maybe like Hayekians or more consequentialists perhaps, but what can they learn from reading Rothbard? Because many less absolutist libertarians encounter Rothbardians and, you know, get called a statist within about 3 minutes. It's often not a productive conversation. But so if someone's going to go read some Rothbard, what could they learn from it? The more important things.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. There's so much diversity under the libertarian label in America, despite Rothbard's huge looming influence, and a very broad swaths. You know, you might kind of divide it up into Rothbardians who tend to be more radical, tend to want, like the natural rights arguments, and tend to be anarchists, and tend to, you know, oppose fractional banking, fractional reserve banking, those kinds of hosted positions, versus the other camp of libertarians that are more, you know, much more indebted to like people like you said, Hayek, who don't subscribe to natural law, who don't have as much of a radical critique as the Rothbardians. And I think that, you know, Rothbardians have plenty to learn from the Hayekians. That's another subject, I guess. But the Hayekians can learn from Rothbard. I think, you know, the natural law view is defensible. I don't think it's impossible to reconcile that with all of Hayek. Although, you know, yeah, it is a completely different moral framework than the one Hayek is working with, which is really skeptical of the power of reason in determining the nature of happiness in some objective way. Hayek relies instead on you know, rules that we can formulate from a more neutral perspective that apply to people equally and help prevent arbitrary discrimination and force and things like that. And so he's not wholeheartedly committed to all force like Rothbard is. I think Rothbard is right on this one. Rothbard critiques Hayek in his Ethics of Liberty. He critiques Hayek's understanding of these concepts and says, you know, this natural law approach is better. It not only is more consistent with the way we think about morality in general and interpersonal morality. And it also grounds a more consistent opposition to the state, instead of this kind of wishy-washiness that maybe Rothbardians get annoyed by Hayekians for. So I think the natural law is the big, and the anarchism that it kind of grounds is the big area where, you know, Hayek's not on board with those firm commitments, but I think there's a lot there.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, make sure to rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Free Thoughts is produced by Landry Ayers. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.